So before I start the next part, just to give you a very simple advice if you want to add something to the parallel code, you know. So so if your part involves no neighborhood information, okay? If your part involves no neighborhood information, then you can do your part in the augmented domain, okay? And proceed just as if it were a serial code. But if your part involves neighborhood information, like ball information, then you do your calculation inside the resident domain. And then after that, immediately after that, you use one of the standard communication routines inside itself to exchange the ghosts. Okay, is that simple enough? Well, it's a pretty simple rule. Okay, so just in case you want to add something to the parallel code, that's the rule you need to remember. You do your well. So next, let's go through the inputs and outputs of a self and discuss some common problems. Okay. So the first step to apply self, of course, you need to generate the horizontal grid. This is one of the time-consuming part, but nowadays with the commercial package, in my experience over the last 8 years is that the time taken to generate unstructured grid, quality, good quality unstructured grid, really cut down a lot, you know. I'm sure most of you agree with me. So they, of course, the unstructured grid you use must satisfy some minimal criteria, like any two elements must not have any overlapping errors, or you don't leave any holes in the interior domain, etc. Okay, so those are the basic conformal conditions. And there are many methods to generate the unstructured grid, and one particular type of unstructured grid and scanning popularity is Denali triangulation. So very briefly, what does the Denali triangulation mean? So if you look at the picture on the bottom, which shows two adjacent triangles, okay, and their respective circumcircles. So if the opposing points, P and Q, the opposing vertices are outside the other circles, other elements circumcircle, that's called a Delany. Okay, and this there are many ways to generate the Delany triangulation. And for interior sides, for interior elements, this can be done relatively straightforward way. But for boundary elements, if you want your entire grid to be purely Delany, then it may involve some insertion of extra points called Steiner points, and that may destroy the efficiency because you may have to add lots of Steiner points on the boundary to make the grid diagonally. But for self, we don't care about this property, but it's a nice property to have. Okay, so as I mentioned, there are a number of packages to generate unstructured grid, and some of them are open source, some of them are commercial, and everybody nowadays seem to agree that SMS is a pretty decent package. And if your applications involves building a very humongous background grid, like a DM grid, okay, and you don't care about the mesh quality, then I found that the Shushak's triangle, which is a freeware you can download from website, is pretty efficient. Okay, I triangulated over 20 million nodes in about half an hour. You know, it's very efficient thing. Of course, the quality will be horrible, but if you don't care about the quality, you know, you want to just use it as a bathymetry grid, then that's great. Yeah. So I typically group the self inputs into categories. Okay, we are now on slide number 19. GR3 files, those are horizontal grid-like files. And the TH files, those are time history files. And .in files, you know, those are the leftovers. You know, basically, I don't know where to put them. You know, which include the vertical grid and hot start, and the parameter files and the lodging files. .ic, those are initial condition files, and all the atmospheric flux forcings are put into a subdirectory called sflux. And if you use Gotten turbulence closure library, then you need additional input called .turb.imp. And .ll file basically essentially same as .gr3, basically it's a NetLong version of .gr3. So if you want, suppose you already got a grid for your new application. Okay, so you want to check its quality. So if you want to use a Shapiro filter, then you need to make sure it does not violate that geometric constraint. So in order to do that, you only need three files, really. Okay, so the hgrid.gr3, and in this case, the depth information may not be correct. You know, may not be the final depth information because it's not important. And the boundary, open boundary and land boundary information may not be the final one you use. You can just fake something up. Doesn't matter. And vertical grid, of course, you need that. And param.in, you need that. Then you turn on the pre-processing flag, IPRE, inside the param.in. And run the code. If you're using parallel version, you can only run this with only one CPU. Okay, that's the constraint. Then the code will report all the geometric violations, including the Shapiro filters and others. And in addition to that, it also output file, which I think is very useful. It's called the sample_z.out. So what this file tells you is sample z coordinates and multiple depths. Okay, so if you want to look at how your vertical grid looks like, then this sample z.out can be very useful. And then here are some tips when you suppose you have some geometric problems, especially for Shapiro filters, you want to edit your grid. So what you do is usually you try to move the loads or swap the edges first, because those two operations will not change the global numbering of nodes. Okay, so easy for you to keep track of what you have done and what's left, basically. And after you've done all those two operations, then you start refining and coarsening the grid near the boundary, okay, in order to satisfy the condition. So before you do that, you probably want to label each violation locations, okay, to remind yourself which one you have done, which one you haven't, okay. Because once you refine the grid or coarsen the grid, the global nodal numbering will be completely off. So as far as the normal run is concerned, now you already passed the pre-processing stage. You want to launch a normal run. There are some mandatory, you know, minimum inputs. All the rest are the conditional inputs, basically based on the choice of parameter you made inside the param.in. Okay. So the mandatory inputs include, of course, the first three we just set the horizontal grid, vertical grid, and param.in, and also in interpol.gr3, which specifies the interpolation method, you know, along S or along Z, and drag inputs. So depending on the choice of parameter inside the param.in, it can be drag.gr3 or rough.gr3. So suppose you've been using the serial version for a while, you want to switch to the parallel version. So here are some tips. Okay, the only difference between the two versions are in those files. Param.in, which in the newest parallel version is free format. Okay. And hotstart.in and lodging files, those are the unformatted binary files, as opposed to binary files in the serial version. And star.g3d.th files have been changed from ASCII to a binary to facilitate very long-term simulations, because those files can become very large, you know, if you use long-term if you want to do a long-term simulation. So next couple of slides, we're going to go through some important input files. We're now on slide 20. So GR3 and LL files, they share very similar structure, okay? So the structure recognizable by the XMGR edit, basically. It's a great editing tool we like to use. So the first line, you can add your own comments, and I really encourage you to add the comments to basically describe how you get this file. The second line specifies number of elements and number of nodes, and followed by the position of each node, so XY coordinates and depth. Okay. And one thing to note is that except for the hgrid.gr3, okay, the only thing that matters for the rest of the GR3 files or LL files is the depth, really. You don't need to have correct X and Y. Okay. The X and Y coordinates are actually not even used inside the code. Okay. We keep this structure mainly for the ease of visualization using XMGR edit. After the coordinates information, then you have a collectivity table for each element. So 3 here means that we are using pure triangular elements. And the 3 local vertices, node numbers. And after that, you have boundary information, so an open boundary and first, and followed by the land boundaries for each segment. Okay. And if you use a GR edit, this boundary information part can be easily generated, you know, when you send GR3. So the vertical grid, of course, is one of the most important thing, you know, in self applications. And there are a number of parameters you can adjust, as we discussed before. So on the upper right corner, you can see a sample vgrid.in file. On the first line, you have 3 numbers. Okay, the first number is total number of S and Z levels. Okay, total number of S Z levels. And second number is the transition level between S and Z. So in this case, 18. And the transition depth between S and Z layers in meters. So in this case, it's 100 meter. And the second line is not really reading, you know, into the self code. It's mainly to enhance readability. So basically, it tells you the followings are the Z levels. The first level from bottom all the way to this transition level, okay, from bottom. So the second column represent the Z coordinates, okay. And you can see that for the very last Z level, this number must be negative of this, right? Otherwise, the code will tell you, you know, there's some mismatch there. And all the Z levels are specified, you need to specify S levels. And the first line of S levels will be 3 numbers. I'm sure you are familiar with them now. So those 3 parameters are using S transformations, so you can tune them to get the desired vertical grid, HC, theta B, and theta F. And then you continue the specification of the Z sigma coordinates from -1 all the way to 0. Okay. And typically, we keep the Z sigma coordinates evenly spaced. We do not manually tune those spacings. And the spacing of the final coordinates is actually adjusted through those parameters, okay, HC, theta B, and theta F. And as I said before, you can always look at some sample Z coordinates and some depths, you know, by running the pre-processing flag. Okay. Now, next couple slides will be on the parameter files, which is, of course, the most important input. So in the newest version, by popular demand, we already changed the format to be free format. So, but there are some rules you need to follow, okay? So any lines beginning with exclamation mark, or for that matter, anything after exclamation mark will be ignored. Okay, treat as comments. So blank lines are also ignored. And the main part of the prime.in are those kind of equations: keywords equals a value. Okay, and the space is allowed after keywords and before value. Okay, and after value, of course, you can add your own comments by using the exclamation mark. And one thing you need to notice is that keywords are case sensitive, and you need to use the keywords we specify in the code. And you can go to the website to find the full list of keywords using prime.in. So there are three types of values. Okay, either the value can be either integer, or real, or two character string. Okay, in the case of a two character string, you don't use the single quote, double quotes around it. Okay, and if the value is a real number, then you can use any of those things. It's pretty flexible in this case. And if the value is a integer, you can even put a decimal point after that if you happen to forget about that. But of course, this is a bad practice. So, but then the decimal point will be automatically removed, you know, inside the code. And of course, because this is a free format file, so you can rearrange the parameters in any order you want. So below is an example of param.in. So I arrange them into, I group the parameters into three categories, but you don't have to follow exactly the same order. Okay, so first the category is called configuration parameters. The first parameter is, you already know, that's the pre-processing flag. And second one is total number of passive tracers. Just remember, if you specify long zero number of tracers, then you need to update the boundary condition part and also other parts in param.in, the output part. Okay, so, and of course, you need to change the source code to update the boundary condition and the body source, etc.
Joseph?
Yeah?
If for whatever reason in tracers equals zero, yeah, doesn't get in the param.in file, is there a check or some sort of a...
Oh, yeah. For that matter, the question is if you forgot to specify a parameter such as n tracers inside the param.in, would the code crash? Oh, yeah, it would definitely crash. And 4.11 will tell you cannot find n tracers. Okay. So the next group of parameters specify the embedded deformation module, okay, if you happen to use them. Okay. And the second parameter, basically IBDEF, basically specify total number of time steps during which the bed is deformed, is moving. And the next three parameters specify the coordinate system. Okay, so you can use lat-long coordinates in a input, but just inside the code, you immediately convert those coordinates using CPP projection. So all the outputs will be in CPP coordinates, okay. So the next, the CPP underscore long and CPP underscore lat specify the projection centers, and the real use of those two parameters are actually when you are using the beta plane approximation for the Coriolis. Okay. That's the lat long number you used to in those approximations. Okay, so if you happen to use this way to specify the Coriolis, you want to make sure these two numbers are correct. Okay, yeah, usually you put in the center of the domain, or you put it in the region of interest, you know. So if, you know, your domain may be very large, a basin scale, but your region of interest is in northwest, and you put a CPP somewhere in the northwest. Okay. So next group of parameters basically specify the barotropic and baroclinic option. Okay. IBCC equals zero, that's the default, it's baroclinic option. And in this case, I transpose, it's not important because you always solve the transpose equation. For barokinetic model, you always solve the ST. But for barotropic model, IBCC equals 1, you can either solve ST or bypass that for efficiency. Okay, have that choice. And next two parameters basically specify, allows you to ramp up the barokinetic forcing. You don't have to use this. If you don't use it, typically you have a little bit of noise coming out initially, but it will quickly disappear. And iHeart basically controls the hard start option. If it's 0, then you are using cold start. And in this case, if you are solving transport equation, then you need to specify the initial ST profile in the some of the following parameters. I hot equals 1 is hot star. I hot equals 2 is also hot star. The difference between 1 and 2 is that if you use I hot equals 1, then you are basically starting from time 0. The time will be automatically reset to 0. Whereas I hot equals 2 is mainly used when your run crashes. Okay, you want to restart the crashed run. So all the outputs, and including the global outputs, will be continuing from where the code crashed. So next group of parameters are related to physics, such as horizontal viscosity and diffusivity. So if you turn on these two flags, then you need to specify the horizontal viscosity, horizontal diffusivities in these two files, hvs.gr3 and hdiff.gr3. Okay. And I didn't talk about this drag formulation, different drag formulations in numerics. But inside itself, we typically use a quadratic drag law. Okay, that's, we assume the turbulence bottom boundary layer. But you can also use laminar boundary layers. In this case, it's a linear drag law. So, but it's not really, normally you don't use a laminar bottom layer. So inside itself, the bottom friction coefficient can be specified in two ways. Okay, the first way, you directly specify the CD. That's B freak equals 0. Then the CD will be specified directly inside this drag.gr3. Okay, so you can specify the CD at each point in space. If IB freak equals 1, then you specify the bottom roughness in meters. Is it in meters? Yep. So by the way, the units used in all those parameters are normally SI units, okay, unless otherwise specified. So if you use B freak, you specify the bottom roughness directly, then the code will ask you for a maximum CD drag coefficient, because in a very shallow region near the wet and dry interface, that CD, calculated CD can be huge. Okay, so this code allows you to impose some kind of limit there. So the way Coriolis parameter is specified itself, you can have a number of options. Okay, if uncore equals minus 1, then you need to specify the mean latitude. Okay, this number here, latitude. Okay, and then if n core equals 0, you directly specify the Coriolis parameter in this Coriolis. And if n core equals 1, that means you are using beta plane approximation. Then you want to make sure that the CPP projection centers before are correct. Okay, and in this case, you don't have to specify anything after uncall. Okay, so those are the parameters controlling the physics. So the first numerical parameter is controls how you want to specify initial condition for S and T. This only matters if you are using cold start, right? For hot start, everything is reading from hot start.in. So if you are using cold start, I say ST equals 1, that means the initial ST field vertically uniform and horizontally varying. specify inside temp and salt.ic. Okay, those two files has a suffix of ic, but they are actually same as .gr3 file. You know, you can use a gr3 file format for them. If I say st equals 2, then the initial st field is specified as vertically varying and horizontally homogeneous. And in this case, the code will automatically remove the mean density profiles for you when it calculates the barokinetic force. Okay. So the next parameter basically specifies if you want, for hot start option, you want to ask the code to remove the mean density profile. Okay, if you turn on this flag, then the code will ask for a file, same file, ts.ic, okay, for removing the mean density. And this interval parameter is one of the most important parameters in param.in. Basically, it controls how the node velocity is computed from side velocity. Remember that from previous lesson? So this interval equals minus 1, that means you are using the non-conformal linear shape function. Equals 0 means you're using conformal shape function. Whereas equals 1, that means you are using simple averaging around the ball. Okay, so if interval is non-positive, so either minus 1 or 0, then the Shapiro filter will be automatically invoked to filter the side velocities to get rid of subgrade oscillations. So the strength of a Shapiro filter is specified in this parameter. Okay, and by default, it's 0.5. You don't really need to change that. So the maximum velocity parameter is only used because in this bulk aerodynamic module, there's a problem if your surface velocity becomes too big. The algorithm may blow up or may not even converge. So for that purpose, we basically allow user to impose the maximum velocity. So typically, you use a very large number, 10, 100, I think up to 200 is okay. But of course, in the real world, you never have 200 meters per second surface flow. So, and the next parameter, well mean B-track, is basically controls when the backtracking routine is invoked. For very small velocity, it's a waste of time to do backtracking, right? So that's a cutoff. So it really depends on the minimum horizontal resolution you use. Okay, if your application, the minimum horizontal resolution is say over half a kilometer, it's 1 millimeter per second, is a pretty decent number. Whereas if your application involves a very fine resolution, then it 10 to minus 4, 0.1 millimeter per second is usually sufficient. Or even for tsunami application, I think the smallest one I used is 10 to minus 5. Okay. So just remember the sparse matrix inside itself, the large one from the Feiler Element method, is positive definite provided that the friction reduced depth is non-negative, right? So the code actually allows you to impose that limit to enhance the robustness. Okay, normally you don't want to turn this flag on, but if your application is absolutely critical, okay, you don't want to fail, then you can turn on this flag. Okay, so to enhance the, so the matrix will be guaranteed to be a positive definite asymmetric. And the inner flag, next one. We are now on slide 26. So the inner flag basically controls how you want to do the inundation. The two algorithms, remember, 0 is the simple one, and 1 is the more sophisticated one, which hasn't been implemented yet in the parallel version. So H0 is the minimum water depth for differentiating wetting and drying. Okay, so typically we use a small positive number, like 1 centimeter here, to prevent the underflow. You don't want to use 0 there. And implicitly, this factor that's more or less obvious. And for numerical stability, you want to specify this theta I to be between 0.5 and 1. 0.5 is ideal, that's Crank-Nicolson, which gives you the highest accuracy. So typically, we use a value very close to 0.5. The problem with 0.5 is that it sits right on the border between the stable solution and unstable solution. So sometimes it can blow up. Okay, so next group of parameters specify the duration of the run and the time step you want to use. And RN day basically is a total run time in days. And the next two flanks specify if you want to ramp up the forcing, like tidal forcing or not. And if you do, then D ramp will specify the ramp up time in days. And DT obviously is a time step. And because we are using implicit model, there's no differentiation. There's only one time step. Okay, there's no internal time step and external time step here. So DT is in seconds. And the next three parameters, you don't really, normally you don't want to tune them. Those are internal parameters used in JCG solver. Okay, tolerance, etc. Okay, now slide 27. And the three parameters that follow specify the advection options for the momentum. Okay, so NADV is the advection flag. If it is one, then you are telling the code you want to use the Euler backtracking. Okay, so if it's equal to 2, then you are using the fifth order adaptive Runge Kata. And if it's equal to 0, then you basically tell in the code that you want to specify the advection methods in a file called adv.gr3. And in addition to that, you can even turn off the advection. If the depth inside the adv.gr3 is 0, that means you want to turn off the advection locally there. If it's 1, then you want to do the advection using the Eulerian backtracking locally. If it's equal to 2, then you are using the Runge Kata methods. Okay, depending on the choice of NADV, the meaning of this next two parameters will change. Okay, so this is a bit confusing. If your NADV is 1 or 2, only the first parameter is used. Second one is not important. You don't have to specify that. The first parameter basically you specifies the minimum time step, you sub-time step allowed for the Eulerian tracking. So if NADV equals 1, this 15 seconds will be the minimum time step, sub-time step allowed. If NADV equals 2, then this parameter specifies the maximum sub-time step allowed. Okay. So that makes sense because the Runge Kata scheme will usually give you a very large time step. So you sometimes you want to control that. You don't want to get it out of hand. Okay. So you can specify the maximum sub-time step here. So if NADV is 0, then both these two parameters are used in the code. The first parameter will be the minimum time sub-time step using Euler, and this one will be maximum sub-time step in Runge Kata. Does that make sense?
So it's kind of max one is actually a minimum.
Max one becomes the minimum, yeah. Max two is the maximum, yeah, in this case. Okay. Of course, you can specify how you want to do interpolation and the footover characteristic line for salinity, temperature, and velocity. So those are specified in the next group of parameters. InterST obviously means the interpolation method for S and T, and InterMOM, that's a UV interpolation methods. Okay, so if InterST equals 1, you are using the split linear methods. Okay, split each triangle into 4. And in InterST equals 2, you are using the quadratic shape function for interpolation. And the InterMOM typically equals 0, that's default. So we typically use the linear shape functions, okay, either conformal or non-conformal, and the photocharacteristic line for U and V. But if you turn on this flag, this intermodal one, the next flag becomes important. This one will specify the type of generalized covariance function using Quiggin. So you are using a Quiggin method here for interpolating S and T, for interpolating U and V. And if you use the shape function, linear shape function, to convert the side velocity to the load velocity, then load velocity becomes discontinuous, right, across the load. Then these two numbers will basically be the blending factor between the continuous velocity part and the discontinuous velocity part. So the first blending factor is for the internal side, and second one is for the boundary. For the boundary, you always want to put zero here. Basically, you are using continuous velocity. And for internal, you can either use this blending factor between 0 and 1. Okay. Any questions so far?
Hi, Joseph.
Yeah.
I have a question about the Roth-Carter method.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the slide, the 10, oh, yeah, you said that the Roth-Carter method, the maximum step is 5. Is that right?
Is what? The maximum
is
step?
For the Roth-Carter, it's 5 iterations.
Then,
on the slide 10.
Yeah, I'm going to slide 10 now. Okay, so the time step is calculated using this adaptive step. Okay, right?
Use 5, but this is the maximum. But here, on the slide 27, that's the talk about the parameter.
Yeah.
That's the, we need to make this one, that's the maximum, the DTB, maximum 1, to equal to 1 or something.
Oh, no. Yeah. Basically, this inside code, this will be delta t prime will be the desired time step for the next sub time step, right? But the code will allow user to actually limit this delta t prime, put a floor, put a ceiling on it. Okay, so you don't allow this code to freely compute delta t prime. If delta t prime exceeds that DTB underscore maximum 1, then they, you are using the DTB underscore maximum 1 instead of delta t prime. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So the I upwind underscore t basically controls the transport algorithm use. Okay, if it equals 0, then you are using EOM methods. And in this case, the interpolation method you use is inter st matters. Okay, if you I upwind underscore t equals 1 or 2, then you are using the upwind or TVD method. And in that case, inter st no longer matters, but you don't care how the ST are interpolated and the foot of a characteristic line. Okay. So if I upwind equals 2, then you are using the second order TVD method, and in addition, you need to specify the next two parameters, TVD underscore MID. Okay, so this one is mainly for my own debugging purpose. Basically, inside TVD, there are two ways to calculate the Courant number condition. So you don't really need to change this. The second one is important one. You specify the flux limiter function. Okay, so in this case, we are using the super B. Okay. So you can choose from a variety of flux limiter functions. And you can find that information on the website. An NWS parameter controls how you want to compute, impose the atmospheric forcing. Okay, if it's 0, then you are not applying any atmospheric forcing. then in that case, all the rest of the lines, all the lex four parameters become line important. Okay. And NWSX1, that means you are applying spatially uniform but temporally varying wind. Okay, inside is a wind.th. That's a time history file. Okay, and then in that case, you need to specify the time step using wind.th. Okay, that's the lex parameter. And you also need to specify if you want to ramp up wind and ramp up period. And the code also allows user to selectively turn off the wind in some regions. So although we actually hardly use this option. You know. So if you decide to turn off the wind near the boundary, for example, you need to specify a grid called windfactor.gr3. Okay. So if NWS equals 2, then you are specifying temporally and spatially varying atmospheric forcing. Those forcings are reading from the netcdf files inside S-flux directory. Okay, we'll talk about that in detail later. So the next two parameters controls whether or not you want to use heat exchange model and salt exchange model. That's a precipitation and evaporation module. If you do decide to use the evaporation and the precipitation model, then you need to make sure you compile your code with that pre-processing flag turned on. Okay. So ITER, next slide, number 29. ITER parameter basically controls what kind of turbulence closure you want to use. So typically we use the 2.5 equation, Umilov and Burchard general length scale turbulence closure model. That's ITER equals 3. Okay. And in this case, you need to specify specifically what kind of turbulence closure model you want to use, which in this case is KKL. Okay. And you also need to specify what kind of stability function you want to use, which in this case is a Cantor-Claisen. Okay. So you can lodge the ST around the boundary. Okay. And in this case, you need to turn this flag on, INU underscore ST. Okay, if it's equal to 0, that means you don't want lodging anywhere in the domain. If it's 1, that means you want ST to be relaxed to the initial condition. Okay. And if INU underscore ST equals 2, that means you want to lodge ST to some kind of specified background field, for example, the results from a global ocean model or some climatology even. So if INUST is non-zero, then you need to specify the time step used in lodging, okay, which in this case is half a day, this in seconds. Right? And the next four parameters are not really used. Okay, so it basically allows you to do selectively lodging for certain vertical layers. So we never use this. So next parameter, depth underscore z sigma, is the new one. Okay, so I added this to basically allow two ways to compute the baryonic force near the bottom. Okay, you can, so if the local depth is greater than this specified depth in meters, then you use a more conservative approach. Basically, the end goal is to not to trigger any spurious flow. Whereas if a local depth is shallower than this, then the code will do a constant extrapolation near the below the bottom. Okay. And so these two parameters are used only for dimensioning inside the inter-B-track subroutines. Okay. So they have low implications for accuracy whatsoever. So if your program crashes and 4.11 complains about these two parameters, you want to selectively increase those two parameters. The first parameter basically controls all the arrays dimensioning, except for the receive queue. Okay, the second one controls the receive queue, because the receive queue can be much larger than send queue, right? In the extreme case, one process will receive information from all its labors, right? But it only send information to specific labors, one at a time. So that's why second one, the parameter is always much larger than the first one. So next slide shows a list of global output options. So the first, the parameter is not really active right now. It basically controls the format of the output. But nSpool and nHscape basically controls the output frequency. nSpool basically tells the code output, global output files every this many iterations. iHfSkip tells the code and generate separate stacks every this many iterations. So you got one. That's why if you look at the output, you get the 1_2_ coming out according to this parameter. Okay. Obviously, iHfSkip must be a multiple of nSpool. Otherwise, the code will crash, I'll tell you then. Okay. So after that, you have a list of global outputs. So those lames are exactly the same as the output lames. So you turn them on and off. One means on, so to tell the code you want this information, such as elevation and of velocity, salinity, temperature. Okay. Those are straightforward. And one thing I like to mention is that for the parallel version, okay, I/O obviously is a bottleneck. So what we decide finally is that to let each process spit out its own subdomain, because there's absolutely no communication whatsoever at output stage. And in addition to that, Ethan also found this nice way of doing a string, non-advanced string output. So if you look at the code, there's a bunch of statements doing this kind of non-advanced. So what it does is that when the code outputs the global output files, you will not write directly to the files on the disk. Instead, you write to the buffer. So if you observe parallel run is ongoing, you'll see that, say for example, here nSpool equals 6, every 6 time steps, there's absolutely no pause. Okay, if you keep writing the buffer, because writing the buffer is much faster than writing to the disk, so there's no pause. And when it reaches 576 time steps, then you can see that buffer, suddenly the every process will empty its buffer and open up new files. And that's also very fast, and just one off. Okay, so in that sense, the parallel self actually, I consulted with a guy in NRL, in terms of IO, it's very efficient. Okay, there's a very little latency there. The drawback of this, of course, is that you need to have code to combine those subdomain output files into one. And we do have a Perl script which is included in the source code package. Yes?
So if it only writes the buffer when it reaches the end of the
empty buffer, which is
the file, it's actually, it only empties the buffer and writes the file when it reaches the IHFSkip.
Yep.
If the model crashes, does it not?
Well, then too bad. The model crashes, then I will talk about the hard start output next slide. So model crashes, the output hard start will not be generated. So when you hard start, it automatically start from previous iHfSkip. Does that make sense?
But for evaluating what happened that caused it to crash, if there's any
then you need to for debugging purpose, then you can reduce this. See? Output more often. Yeah, that's how you do debugging. So next slide, 31. So the next two parameters basically control if you want to output the hot start, okay, for restarting. Okay, if you turn this first flag on, I hot out, then you will output the this hot start output files every this many steps, iterations. Okay, of course this number must be divisible by this IHF escape number. Okay. Otherwise the code will tell you that. Yes?
Joseph?
Yep.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yep.
This parameter int format is available in parallel version or zero version?
Only in parallel version. Okay? Only in parallel version, not in zero version.
Hi, Joseph.
Yeah?
I have a question about this file, param.in. Where are the information about the tracer?
Oh, okay, that's a good question. Tracer information, yes. If you go to website, towards the end of the description, you can find how to specify the tracers. Yeah, I didn't include that in my slides. Yeah, but I know many of you are concerned doing tracer transport. Yeah, so that's probably something I should talk about. Yeah, but if you
could. Okay, thank you.
Right. So the very last flag basically specify if you want to do some optional flux checking. Okay, if you do, then you need to specify an input file called fluxflag.gr3, which I'll talk about briefly later. So as you, if you are familiar with zero version of self, you can see that inside new param.in, we are omitting the boundary condition and the tidal frequencies, right? So those are being pushed to this new input file called bctide.in. Okay, so because they cannot be easily incorporated inside the param.in, and lots of people claim that it doesn't really make much sense to include them in the param.in anyway. So what you see here inside this file are basically what left over from the old param.in. Okay, the first line specifies the starting time. Okay, in this format, and in many cases, this is really mostly used for post-processing. You know, it's not really important for most applications. And the second line basically specifies the Earth tidal potential option. Okay, the first number is a flag. If you turn it on, then you are using Earth tidal potential as a body force. And in that case, you need to specify the frequencies and the nodal factor and the arguments, all those extra things. And the second one is the cutoff depth. Basically, you tell the code that you don't want a code to calculate the Earth tidal potential when the depth is shallower than, say, 40 meters. So the next 19, also nines, basically specifies the total number of tidal frequencies you want to use and the frequencies and the nodal factor and the equilibrium arguments for each frequency. So those are the nodal factor and the equilibrium arguments are only function of starting time. Okay, they are not a function of the space. So next part, you specify the open boundary conditions. So total number of open boundaries and the first open boundary, second open boundary here. Okay, so first number is always the total number of nodes inside that particular segment of open boundary, and followed by four flags, boundary condition flags, for elevation, velocity, and temperature and salinity. Okay, so you go to the website, you can find the full descriptions of what these flags are. And I just want to mention that first thing, they for Z0 frequency, of course, the phases do not matter. Okay, so for this particular case, it matters for all other frequencies. And also, if you use a negative flag, typically that means you are using the open boundary condition, some kind of radiation boundary condition. And in that case, in many cases, you need to specify relaxation constant. In this order. Okay. Okay. interpol.gr3 is one of the compulsory inputs itself. So you always have to have this file. So the way, basically inside this file, there are only two depths, okay, one and two, basically specify two regions, region one and region two. Region one means that you want code to do interpolation along Z, whereas two, the interpolation is done along S. So the rule is that inside the SZ, the hybrid coordinate zone, you can only do interpolation along Z, because it doesn't make any sense to do interpolation along S, because S coordinates do not exist in Z layers. Whereas inside the S zone, then you can have options, either one or two. But usually we advise using the along S-plane interpolation here. So obviously, the boundary between region 1 and region 2 in this case will be tied to the parameter in vagrid.in.hs, okay, the demarcation depths between S layer and Z layer. Okay, so the this one, the isobar, this boundary will be isobars over 100 meters. So hotstar.in, this input file is probably is not important for most of you, but some of you do want to go into this file and do some manipulations, okay, when you do hotstar. So here is a description of the format. Okay. As I mentioned, in parallel version, it's not a binary file, it's an unformatted binary. So it has three major parts, element data, site data, and node data. So you, inside each block, you can see the specification of all sorts of internal state variables. They are all here, okay. So for example, the element data, the IDRYE, that's the waiting and drawing flag for each element. And this is a vertical grid. This is the TNS and the prison centers. And this is a tracer concentration if you use a tracer. Okay, and for this site data, this is a waiting drawing flag, and this is a site velocity UV, and T and S and site centers. Okay, this may not be used if you use, say, upwind or TVD, okay, but they are there always. And node data includes all the waiting drawing flags, elevation, in this case, and T and S and nodes, and the initial T and S. And all sorts of TKE and mixing lengths and diffusivities, mixing coefficients. Okay, so the logging files basically has information at each time steps specified in param.in. Okay. This time step may be different from the model time step you used. So basically, for each time step, you have a time stamp and all the temperature and salinity at loads and each vertical level. And again, this large input files, they are in the unformatted binary, okay, format. So it's different from the serial version. There are two types of time history files for parallel version. First type uses ASCII. They are relatively small. Okay, second one, the 3D.th file, those are binary files because they are relatively large. So the ASCII time history files include the flux.th, temp.th, salt.th, and elif.th, and wind.th. Except for wind.th, all the time steps used in other files are the same as model time step. Okay, wind.th is a special case. You specify the time step used in wind.th inside param.in. Okay, as we explained later, explained it before. So another thing is that flux.th, you specify the discharge instead of U and V. Okay, so just remember that the negative values means inflow. Okay, that's one of the common mistakes people make. So those types of TH files usually correspond to the boundary flag of one, time histories, and Q here is a sample of this .th file, what it looks like. The first column, you can see the time in seconds. Second column is the value needed and the first open boundary that uses this type of boundary condition. Okay, followed by second and et cetera. So obviously this file is very easy to plot, so easy to debug. But just remember, if you reorder your open boundary segments, then you need to change this file as well. Okay. So 3d.th files, those are binary files, which include the ELIF3D and TEM3D, SOUTH3D, UV3D. And in this case, just remember that UV3D files basically specifies the U and V components, not discharge. Okay. Those are direct UV components. And the 3D.th file usually are needed when you specify a boundary flank of plus or minus 4. Okay, so the format for those kind of files are really simple, you know. It consists of a number of time steps, okay, value and each time step, and the timestamp and the value and each open boundary segment, open boundary loads, and vertical levels if it's 3D variable. Okay, slide number 37. Okay, so the initial condition files for S and T are needed if you are using code start, and the format of this file depends on the value of a parameter you choose, you know, IC, ST. Because one, the temp.ic and salt.ic, those are the .gr3 format, actually. Okay, basically specifies temperature and salinity, initial values, and each loads. If IC ST equals 2, or if you turn on this IBCC underscore mean, that means you want to remove the mean density, then you need to specify the T and S in the vertical profile of them. So this is what the TS.IC looks like. It's very simple. First one is total number of vertical levels, followed by the description of each level. And for this second column, the coordinates from bottom to surface, and followed by temperature and salinity. The depth at your inside your domain is outside this specified range, okay, below bottom or above surface, so the code will actually do extrapolation for you. It's constant extrapolation. Any questions so far? So I like to spend a little bit of time on this S-flux files because lots of users are interested in using this option. So of course you need this those files when you use NWS equals 2 or 3 inside param.in. So this directory has a number of netcdf files. Those are netcdf files reformatted from NSAID products. Okay, they're just a simple formatting. Because there are lots of unnecessary variables, so we don't really use in self. We just get rid of them and reformat it into a netcdf. So there are three types for this kind of files: the AIR, RAND, and the PRC. And AIR, inside the AIR file, you can find the wind speed, air pressure, and the surface air temperature. And RAND file, you can find the downward long wave infrared radiation, and as well as solar radiation inputs. And PRC files basically specifies only one variable, the precipitation. And this is those files are optional. They are needed only if you are using the precipitation module. Okay.
Joseph, if you happen to be doing a run outside of the
The question is if you do run outside Pacific Northwest, for example in Portugal, what are the changes? Well, obviously you do change the the grid. Inside those files, actually, you also have the atmospheric grid information. You need to change that grid, right? Make sure you cover the region of interest.
So you mean the grid that they have, and these are those locations on their servers, the way they organize the values? You have to make that change in the code and recompile?
Oh, no. You don't have to recompile the code. But you do want to make sure your hgrid.gr3 is contained in the atmospheric grid specified in those files. Okay. Because you want to do interpolation, right? So you want to make sure that your hgrid.in is inside this atmospheric grid.
So okay. The code that I would use to create all of the SFlex files, that script,
mm-hmm.
There's an area in there where I would change which grid to get from the servers to get the correct area to match my actual model grid.
If you have a choice of atmospheric grid, you want to make sure that your atmospheric grid is bigger than your hgrid.gr3. You want to make sure that, yeah.
Well, I'm trying to ascertain whether, when you say atmospheric grid, if you're talking about a file on my computer or just the...
No, it's inside.
That I
no, oh, no, it's inside. It's inside those dead city files, you can find XY coordinates of that, those grid. That's
so
atmospheric grid.
By
Latitude and longitude, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you don't just get one file from NARR. You have to go pick the correct file for your region, correct?
Yeah. NARR is always fixed region. It's the North America region.
Okay.
Yeah. And GFS is a global. That's global forecast. So it covers the entire globe.
Okay.
So if you do want to manipulate or create your own SFlux files, here are my suggestion. You know, you always start from existing ones. I uploaded onto the website in utility library. Okay, those LAR files, which cover an extensive period, you start from them. Okay, if possible, of course, your application must be inside the North America, and then. You download those to your disk, and just remember that each LAR files roughly covers one day. Okay, there are some overlaps between the files. That's just from NSEP. Okay, and then inside your run directory, you make this directory called SFlux, and inside the SFlux directory, you basically create a bunch of symbolic links. Okay, so the first file here, 001 will link to the starting day of your run, right? And for the last day, you always want to be careful. You want to add one extra day to take into consideration the time zone difference. Because in most cases, actually in all cases I've dealt with so far, the time coordinates in those atmospheric files is in UTC. Okay, so if your application you are using local time zone, you need to take into consideration the time zone differences. Okay, so some people ask, what is a one mean? So this is really a legacy thing. Basically, Mike Zuloff inside the Mike's code, he allows a user to use up to two sources, you know, for each quantity, okay. And inside the code, you automatically blend these two sources according to some predefined weighting factors. So, but in 99% of cases, you don't really need two sources for each variable. So you just use one here. So this file, you need to have this file inside the sflux.gr3. Basically, it's a text file, which specifies your time zone. Okay, UTC underscore star is parameter inside. It's hours behind UTC. So if you are running in a region ahead of UTC, okay, east of Greenwich, then this number should be negative, right? Right? So we are basically all egocentric here. and another thing to notice is that the atmospheric grid files need not be the same as your hgrid.jsp, as I explained, okay, but must be larger, okay, in order for the interpolation to be successful. Another thing is that because of this time zone difference, if you happen to be in a zone east of Greenwich, okay, and this starting file may not have enough time, may not have the values for the time you needed, because they are ahead of GMT, right? This one starts from zero. So in that case, you actually use the previous day. The code actually will automatically try to find that particular day for you. Okay. So if you are familiar enough with the format of this, those NetCDF file, by the way, there's a small Fortran code inside the utility library. So you can look at the internal formats of those NetCDF files. After you're familiar enough with, then you can generate your own NetCDF file. Just one thing to note, okay, the atmospheric forecast usually gives you the relative humidity, whereas inside self model we are needing the specific humidity. Okay, there's a conversion there which is not really straightforward, but that's something you need to take notice of. So if you create your own sflux files and then your code crashes, so it happened before, and this is most likely due to some internal dimensioning parameters, except the especially associated with the atmospheric forcing grid. Okay. So what you do is you can go inside the sflux .f90 code and find this module, letcdf_io, and then you find all those dimensioning parameters. So maximum number of files, maximum number of steps, and increase them, and recompile. So the interpolation from the atmospheric grid to hgrid.gr3 is done at runtime inside self. Okay. But the weights, the interpolation weights are pre-computed once and used repeatedly. Any questions for sflux files? Okay.
So, there's the issue with the wind direction being.
Right. Right. Yeah, another thing, Charles just mentioned that you must be careful. Sometimes inside the weather forecast files, the wind speed refers to the direction wind is blowing from. Okay, that's a convention followed by atmospheric signs. Whereas, as far as oceanography is concerned, we use the wind speed inside the.
Actually, that wasn't the one I was thinking of.
No.
The issue that I was thinking of is that the wind in the atmospheric files is going to be specified. Because it's specified as U and V, so it doesn't, the problem in U isn't a problem.
Right.
But the wind is specified relative to
true
north and true east, but the values that need to be used inside of the model are relative to X and Y.
Which Yeah, Charles just mentioned that there may be a slight discrepancy between the true north assumed in those atmospheric files and the north direction used inside itself. Okay, there's maybe a slight deviation depending on the location. So that's why we allow user to specify that deviation inside the file called windrot_rot.gr3. Yeah, it's a file there. Yeah, you basically specify that mismatch in angles. So so this flux flag.gr3 is only needed if you want to do some conservation checks. Okay, so very briefly, the depth option for depth inside this file can be 0, 1, 2. Okay, 0, that means the regions is outside the region of interest. 1 and 2 are the regions of interest. And the boundary between 1 and 0 and 2 and 0 are where the fluxes are computed. And in addition, the code will also compute the total volume, total mass, etc. inside these regions 1 and 2. So it's basically doing some kind of conservation checks. So the Lagin parameter input, TNS underscore large.gr3, you basically at each load specifies the relaxation constant. Okay. So for example, in this case, you want to large away from the region of interest, which is the Columbia River. So the Lagin, the depths will vary from 0 all the way to this number. Okay. So that's the relaxation constant. Of course, in this case, we are Lagin too much. You can see that it's very close, too close to the region of interest. So you all know that you can find lots of useful information on the web, and especially I like to mention that the utility library is really growing, so you may want to check there. And another thing is that all the exchange between users are archived at this URL. Okay, so you can always go back and do some search there. And I'm particularly interested in your experience to add into this frequently asked question section of the website. So this is the second last, I believe. Yep. Slides. So just the various issues when you run self. Of course, you need to be careful when you design the vertical grid. You always try the pure S coordinates first before you try optional Z layers. And you want to adjust the spacing parameters to fit your specific applications. And as I said before, try not to adjust those sigma coordinates inside vgrid.in. Okay. And in terms of time step, this is a little bit counterintuitive for those people who are not familiar with EOM. You know, because ELM is used inside self, and the EOM is most accurate when the time step is large. So it's kind of counterintuitive there. The reason is that for larger time step, the numerical diffusion introduced by the EOM method is the smallest. So for that reason, you always want to use largest possible time step. Okay, you can afford without exciting the numerical noise. And in terms of choice of implicit factor, as I said before, you always try to choose start from a value close to 0.5, okay, and adjust from there, you know, because a fully implicit method will be sometimes be too dissipative. And when you adjust this interval and the creaking parameters, just remember there's a constant battle between the numerical diffusion and dispersion. So you need to be careful there. You can actually tune number of parameters, including the blending factors, to get the desired level of diffusion and dispersion. So those are the handles you can use. And probably in the near future, I'll publish upload our scripts used to nesting grids. Okay, in some applications, this can be very useful, especially you want to speed up the things. So we have a number of scripts for this purpose, to nest the small domain into the large domains. And basically, those types of time history file becomes very useful. Okay, you impose you basically calculate the boundary condition for the small domain from the larger domain, and basically do interpolation to get this kind of 3D.th files. Those can be very useful sometimes. And the last one is, I won't talk too much, but it's really a legacy issue. You know, if you're still using EOM for estuary river, sometimes the estuary becomes too fresh, and there are a number of tricks to deal with that. So we haven't really talk about the post-processing and visualization yet. I know this is an important issue for many of you. And in the next tutorial section, the next lesson, I will go through some of the tools we used here. By the way, next lessons probably will not be broadcast online because many of you joining from a remote site will not have access to our cluster. So as I mentioned before, there's a simple Perl script you can use, but this Perl script does assume that you understand some structures of your cluster. Okay, that's a drawback, but allows you to combine the outputs as you go. And we have our own scripts to extract the vertical profiles, horizontal slabs, transects, you name it, okay, X, Y, Z, T, basically. And we have those things that we are happy to share. But recently, there's a push among unstructured grid models to come up with a common NetCDF OpenDAP format that's still ongoing. So hopefully, it will be done soon, and we'll have a standard model API for NetCDF OpenDAP outputs soon. Okay. So another thing is that some of you asked me about some strange problems in weighting and drawing. So suppose you do an interpolation at x, y point in space, and that point, based on the elevation at that particular point and the depth there, it's actually wet, but you get invalid salinity and temperature values there. So that's well, I already explained this because of the indices, weighting and drying indices, and loads and sides and elements. Okay, excuse me. So because of those three groups of indices, sometimes you have this kind of problem. So in that case, always trust your final results. Okay, if your final results is S&T. Are invalid, and that means that point is dry, even though the elevation says it's wet. Okay, so in terms of visualization, we are moving away from ACE tools to MATLAB and VisTrio, but unfortunately, how many years now, we still haven't got them running?
We actually, in the past 2 days, have decided to move to Visit. The
okay.
Program that is currently used for FDCOM. And we, in the next month, will be writing the module for reading all self output.
Okay, that's good news because Visit is open software software, so you can download from website. But I just hope that you guys will figure out the solution to the efficiency issue of Visit. I used the Visit before. It's extremely, extremely slow.
It's, we haven't actually, we need to deal with that.
Yeah. So next lesson, I will give you a brief tutorial of my favorite tools so far, ACE tools, okay, GREdit and Viz. Those are still my, including G3, that's a three-dimensional visualization tools. Okay, so that's that concludes the lesson.